So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety. Welcome to another episode of the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And yeah, it's true. It's me. It's my voice. I'm actually here this week.
In person.
David, I've missed you.
Not a hologram. I miss you too. This has been interesting not having my my person to bounce back and bounce off
and
of.
I've got to tell you, I've been saddened to come to the recognition that really the podcast hasn't suffered from my absence.
Well,
I have. The episodes have been great, excellent guests, very able interviews. It's been a joy to listen, and it's great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back, Nate.
Yeah,
it's
always
great.
I'll tell you what, David, I've been on a lot of airplanes lately, had a lot of time to read. I've been geeking out on, you know, scientific shit.
I like how those words go together so well.
Oh no, I'm just fascinated these days about by neurology, the study of the human brain, and really the extended brain, the way really the entire body is wired, and how all of that relates to health, and to recovery from addiction. I think. More and more, which is best described as healing, right?
Yeah. That brain, body, soul connection. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I, you know, you referenced Kurt Thompson's book, Anatomy of the Soul, a number of times in earlier episodes of the show, and I finally got to it.
Good.
Yeah. You know, it's very Christian. Jesus-y in a lot of places, and scientifically, I mean, really detailed.
Yeah.
And that guy has such a great aptitude for explaining, making the complex simple, bringing a layman like me into the conversation so I understand, I can grasp the concepts.
Yeah,
it's been an exciting book to read, and I've been reading several others.
Yeah.
Which is why I'm glad we've got a guest. We've got kind of a scientific guest coming on today.
Yes, we do. We are really going to focus and bear down on the medical aspects of disordered behavior where substances and other things are concerned. But, you know, from where I sit, Nate, everybody comes in and has a particular ideology based on how we've been influenced in culture by what we think addiction is and who is an addict, and we've forgotten that these are human beings that have a physiological disorder, and to talk to a medical doctor about what it is and how they, from where they sit, treat substance use disorder and the addicted mind and brain, and it is going to be a fascinating talk.
Yeah, so this, brace yourselves. Hang on. This is a very sharp young man working at one of the top research hospitals in the country and focusing much of his work on addiction. So stay with us. You're going to like this. We'll be back in a minute on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And our guest today is a local boy made good. Hayden Schaefer, who I first met when he was a young man. Gosh,
It's great to talk to you, Hayden. It distresses me greatly that you don't have a camera on your work computer there, so I can't see you. So in my mind, you're still about 16. Hayden left Franklin, Tennessee to go to medical school at East Tennessee, and then he is now in his third year of medical residency, University of North Carolina. He's a family medicine physician, a primary care guy. However, he has a great interest in a subspecialty in addiction medicine. And that is the reason why we wanted to have him on the show. Thank you so much for taking some time out of what I'm sure is a very busy schedule there, Hayden, to talk to us about what you are learning there on the front lines, on the cusp of new research, and really in the trenches of primary treatment, what you're learning about addiction.
Nate, David, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'm like Nate. I still have you. Of course, I've seen you hundreds of times since you have been away, Hayden, but you really still are about 11, so I'm sorry. That just says more about my age and Nate's age than it does your maturity, so understand that.
Let me ask you if a personal question, if I can, Hayden. Why an interest in addiction?
You know, it was not necessarily something that I sought out, and I think wholly, I would say I am fortunate that the medical community as a whole is beginning to pay attention to the pathology of addiction more and more. And mm-hmm. So it was actually integrated into my medical school training. And I think 10 years ago, you wouldn't be able to say the same. Doctors who were trained were not really to focus on the pathology of addiction so much unless they sought psychiatric training. But really what's begun to happen is realizing that because addiction is pervasive, that it has to be integrated into the primary care setting. Sure. And so it simply started with patients I would meet in medical school who initially it was primarily opiate use disorder, particularly in moms who were pregnant. And there was a law that was passed in Tennessee that has since been repealed. Back when I was in medical school, that indicated that mothers who gave birth and who were to have a positive urine toxicology screen were at risk of being jailed after the delivery of their infant. Wow. And so that, to me, from a social justice standpoint, simply I don't think addresses, one, the addiction difficulties that mother suffers from, nor does that put her infant in really a better place themselves.
Right.
And so that really compelled me to move on into family medicine and specifically seek out training that would allow me to continue to focus on the primary care aspects of addiction medicine during training.
Wow.
Man.
Yeah, so you see patients now as a resident on a daily basis. You have a workload. Are you seeing, how prevalent is addiction in your current patient load? How often do you see it?
It's significantly prevalent. I think part of that is how my patient panel has kind of built up around itself, and I've become known within the department that I'm one of those people who certainly seek out to see patients struggling with substance use disorders. Mm-hmm. I would say it's at least 20% of my primary care panel where we focus on addiction. Now, that said, if you were to ask me how many of my patients could benefit from discussing substance use disorders who are in the stages of actualizing that in their lives or wherever, it's probably a significant greater population, probably closer to 35%.
Yeah, wow. And I'm struck by your use of the phrase substance use disorder. Do you prefer that to addiction language?
So it depends on the way that you, I think words are very important when we're talking about substance use. And I think in particular, one of the things I don't like is when people may refer to my patients as addicts, right?
Yeah.
You know, this is, if we're going to be serious about treating addiction like a medical illness, it's better not to label patients based on their diagnosis. For example, I don't really like it when patients who suffer from liver disease are called cirrhotics, right? That's kind of a degrading term and degrades somebody down to one pathology that is a part of their life. But it's just that, it's a part of their life and it's not who they are.
Right.
And so that's why I don't appreciate when, you know, other providers or even patients refer to themselves necessarily as right off the bat and say, I am an alcoholic. I think that's a bit controversial. But what I would say is that you suffer from alcohol use and that you suffer from addiction, but that your identity is more so than that of being, quote, an addict.
And I really appreciate that addiction, that distinction. It's sad to me that those of us who have developed, you know, compulsive behaviors, whether they're process addictions or substance use disorders, have been stigmatized and really have stigmatized ourselves, walked willingly into the deep waters of shame, mm-hmm. and then tried to find our feet there. And it's very difficult to do when you're labeling yourself using very shameful language. It takes the hope away.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hayden, you know, the DSM for behavioral health encourages us to use the word substance use disorder now as well. And one of the things that I was having a conversation with a colleague the other day about was simply the fact that not only is the word addict and addiction, can be very stigmatizing, but our culture has such an imprint with that word, as such a relationship with that word, that it's minimized and it really doesn't mean what it means, I guess, to the culture anymore. I'm addicted to chocolate, I'm addicted to whatever, but people aren't equating addiction with the same things anymore. And it's been really complicated for our folks to come in, because everybody, you know, every parent I meet that has a 17-year-old that smokes weed thinks they're an addict.
Hmm.
Yeah. You know?
I think it's this unusual dichotomy of, I think people can playfully use the term addict. Like you said, you know, I'm a, you know, that the one I particularly hate is chocoholic. I don't know why it exists. It's just kind of a ridiculous term. But then you also have the, I mean, it completely dehumanizes people in the other sense. And so, you know, if you hear about a death of someone on a news and then you find out that the method of death was overdose, and then you say, well, it was an addict, it demeans that person's life entirely. And it distances whoever is using that phrase, it distances them from the human nature of that person. Mm-hmm. And so it's this term that I think is really not particularly helpful anymore, especially when we're talking about a medical approach to a medical problem.
Right. And so are you guys, I say you guys, meaning, you know, residents and people at your stage of the medical profession coming into it, are you seeing more encouragement to ask more questions about how people use other substances when you prescribe certain medicines now, and things like that, because of the nature of substance abuse. So in other words, if I have a client that has a history of abusing alcohol, but he goes to the doctor for anxiety and the doctor goes ahead and prescribes, you know, Xanax and mm-hmm. things like that, you know, what are your thoughts on that kind of thing?
Yeah, so I think especially located around academic medical centers, we have developed policies and staying up to date on the medical literature that recommending that, for example, treatment of generalized anxiety or episodes of anxiety, that benzodiazepines like Xanax are not first line, mm-hmm. and that they are habit forming, and that they can be dangerous. They have their medical uses, but certainly not a first line approach. Now the job of kind of academic medicine is to try and propagate that information to community medical providers. And so when I see patients who are often on high doses of benzodiazepines, they almost universally come from community providers who I think, don't interact with the way that the medical literature has changed over the years. Mm-hmm. And so these patients who find themselves on extraordinarily high doses of benzodiazepines are just with a doctor who, at the time of that training, that was the norm and may right. or may not have adapted. And I think that brings me to the point of, you know, are we paying attention to the substances that we prescribe? Absolutely, because I think anytime I meet someone who has difficulties with opiate use, almost mm-hmm. universally that person's first opiate came prescribed by a physician, right?
Right.
And
right.
so very rarely do I ever meet someone whose first encounter with an opiate is heroin. It's almost always someone's pill, whether it was theirs or someone else's, and it came from us. And so we have this responsibility. I think definitely the younger generation of physicians feel the responsibility to kind of undo the damage that's been done, one, by physicians, but two, by the pharmaceutical industry that certainly pushed this.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Hayden, I've been fascinated lately by what I've been reading about the neurology of, I don't know how to change my vocabulary here. I want to say the neurology of addiction. I don't know what's the right way to say it, but the way the brain changes as we medicate and modulate, moderate emotion, for example, or try to deal with anxiety by using some substance or activity, the way that there are these changes in the prefrontal cortex, and you can see this stuff now on brain scans,
right?
And then it, from what I gather, as the brain heals, as the toxic behavior, the toxic substance is eliminated, and new neural connections are made, and a new way of living comes about, the changes then occur, this plasticity in the brain. There's a healing right. process that again is visible. Can you talk to us at all about that? Am I completely off base, or is that part of what you, do you take a look at these disorders from a neurological standpoint?
Absolutely. For example, you know, I think what you're referencing mostly is fMRI or functional MRI studies that do neuroimaging to look at the different neurotransmitters that change in relationship to the substance that is predicated mm-hmm. in the substance use. And so, for example, with prolonged alcohol use, we know exactly which parts of the brain are going to change and why. Do we often go and image these things ourselves? Usually not. It's more of a research inquiry than anything, because we can often say, well, you're exhibiting this symptom, which is subsequently due to the change that we would expect.
Yes.
And so we don't need to go do the imaging because we know it's there. I will say that having had some patients who we have kind of a before and after, is that it's remarkable the changes that do occur when people are able to decrease their use, and that they do exhibit significant recovery symptoms. And so, anybody out there who thinks that, you know, oh, am I already suffering from a neurochemical imbalance? Is it reversible? The answer is often yes. It may not be 100%, but functionally, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it will be probably a progressive change.
Certainly takes time. I mean, nerves are the longest, you know, they take forever to replace. They're a slow dividing cell. Neurons, whether it's in the brain or peripheral nerves, that take just such a long time to recover. So it's a patient process, but having been able to look at some people who are 5 years into their journey, it's remarkable the changes they can make.
Oh, it's just so beautiful to hear that. It just is so beautiful to hear. But also, I mean, to counsel folks who are on this journey now, I have a dependency story that's not around a substance, but around a behavior, right? And I was so impatient and so angry with myself early on. I'm going to set the land speed record for recovery. And somehow, an ability to do that is a reflection on my intelligence, on my moral capacity, on my value as a human being, on my sincerity as a Christian, when really a lot of that is just a function of biology.
Right.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, Hayden, when you're dealing with someone and you're and they're talking about sobriety, what does that word mean in the medical community? That may be a silly question, but what does that word mean to you guys when you hear that?
You know, I think I take the term sobriety with a grain of salt and try and not make it so black and white, because right. for some people, sobriety means absolutely no substance use. And I think that's typically what most people imagine, mm-hmm. and is kind of the holy grail of recovering from a substance use disorder for some patients. But mm-hmm. the reality is that for many people, say if you're using alcohol up to an amount of say 2 cases of beer a day, and through treatment you're able to decrease to 1 case of beer a day, that is a significant improvement from where you've come from. Mm-hmm. And so while it is not what you or the patient or society may deem as sober, when looking at somebody's entire substance use recovery process, we still have to acknowledge these significant milestones.
Right.
Because if you're always holding yourself to this one particular goal, anything short of that is demoralizing. It's in the mm-hmm. same way that when I work with patients with weight loss, and we you may not always have the reduction in a weight every time you step on a scale, but look at the healthy changes that you've introduced into your life and look at how you're feeling. So mm-hmm. I don't always set, 100% substance sobriety or absence of substance as the goal for my patients, mm-hmm. because that also sets them up for when there are setbacks. And I importantly say when, because almost nobody goes through a process where they go from use to no use and never has a setback.
Right.
And so you have to set these, parameters around your goals. Otherwise, you're going to reinforce the demoralizing process of not having control of something, which, when a patient comes in and they're treated for high blood pressure and they come in and their blood pressure isn't normal, we don't freak out about it. We don't lament it like we might do when somebody has a setback in their substance use.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because we blame the person with the disorder for not being able to perfectly do something that their brain's not even really cooperating with them fully yet to do. Would that be true?
Absolutely. I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah. And so how do we help in recovery culture? How do we help reshape the way people think about harm management, as opposed to something that is always, it's not going to be all or nothing at first, and that there is an appropriate, there's kind of a bridge period maybe between not using and where they were.
Right.
How can we help families feel like they're understanding that transitional season, and that season may be longer than 30 days. How do we do that?
I think you specifically referenced one term that I think is really important for people to focus on, which is harm reduction or harm prevention. Mm-hmm. Meaning that every choice we make in helping someone with substance use should be focused on harm reduction in some way. So mm-hmm. say, for example, I have patients with opiate use disorder who are on medication-assisted therapy with buprenorphine. Mm-hmm. Sometimes those patients also use marijuana. Mm-hmm. And the question comes up, it says, if we're really trying to treat addiction for these patients in substance use, do we need to necessitate that they have total sobriety from all substances to continue their medical therapy? Mm-hmm. And my answer to that question is I'm here to reduce their harm. So if they are taking buprenorphine and that's helped decrease their opiate use, which is definitely more harmful than marijuana use from a medical standpoint,
right?
Their continued marijuana use, though not ideal, is not a reason for me to deny somebody care, right? Mm-hmm. in the same way that if a patient misses an appointment to refill their medication for their buprenorphine, you know, certainly in that one instance, that's, you know, I could easily say that patient's not adherent. They can go somewhere else for their care. That's the easy answer. Right. The hard answer is to say, you know what, this is part of the pathology, right? Because falling in to opiate use disorder affects so many social dynamics of your life that go into just making a doctor's appointment. It's really tough.
Yeah.
And so what I encourage is that sometimes I'll have, say, you know, you referenced families, you know, sometimes I have families come to the doctor's appointments if the patient is okay with that. Mm-hmm. And we can talk and reflect together about how this process goes, because sometimes while education is helpful for the patient, sometimes, you know, families need to hear it too. They really do.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Because those expectations come with a lot of shame. Potentially,
right,
for the patient if they're not adhering in a way that the family's been told, maybe by other addiction recovery professionals that they should, you know, expect.
Right. And the one I see often is someone struggling with substance use disorder is living with their parents and they aren't able to maintain 100% substance use free status. Mm-hmm. And their parents say, well, then you cannot stay with us anymore. And the fact is that, and this is granted a personal decision for a family and what that looks like based on their safety, but recognizing that moving someone from a housed to an unhoused status is incredibly detrimental. Mm-hmm. And almost certainly will potentiate their substance use. And so just considering those things.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned marijuana earlier, which is the, that's like, that's like, I don't know whether to call it the landmine of the recovery discussion or the holy grail, or,
oh my goodness, yeah,
on, you know, which end of the spectrum people land on with it. And of course I've got, you know, 16-year-olds that are all, you know, little pharmacists, and they can make cases, you know, in all kinds of ways, for marijuana use. And but what I wonder if you could address is your opinion where things like, you know, the oils and the waxes and things like that are concerned, where we're not talking about just harm reduction with marijuana, but some 17-year-old, let's just hypothetically say, is maybe going to hear that and go, see, I, you know, so my pen is fine, you know, or whatever.
So the medical community absolutely does not have a consensus on how they feel about marijuana right now. And that's reflected by, we have states that it's legal for medical use and for recreational use. And then we have states like Tennessee, North Carolina, where it's not. And the medical uses for marijuana are so varied. I mean, it can be used in such a variety of conditions that, you know, certainly you could bring on a doctor who would come in and defend marijuana up and down for every bit of its use and say it does not have addictive properties and things like that. What I can say is that when I really sit down to try and address marijuana use with someone, it's typically in adolescence. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, and it's quite simple, it's that their brains are simply not, they're not done forming. Right. And what I do know, and I think you could get most doctors to agree on, is that it does impact neurodevelopment, period. Mm-hmm. Right. And we know that marijuana use, especially in teenagers, goes on to impact what we call educational attainment. Mm-hmm. And so while you may occasionally encounter a teenager who is exceptionally smart and uses marijuana, what we do know is that it goes on to affect educational attainment. So while they may have a 4.0 GPA, we do know that they are significantly less likely to complete college, to complete higher level education goals, or even graduate high school. And so it is something that with my teenagers, I'm very conscious of. And, you know, I think it's, we find ourselves in this very weird position where with the advent of Juuls and e-cigarettes that, you know, marijuana use doesn't look like it did 10 years ago or 20 years ago. It's not people rolling blunts in the back of cars as much anymore. It's, you know, their friend brought back something when they were visiting their cousin in California and they went to the Apple store of
yeah,
you know, of weed and brought back this cool thing. And so, you know, I think people over the age of 25, I focus more on how marijuana use impacts their life, similar to how you would look at any substance use disorder and, mm-hmm. and the DSM criteria about that. And I think that's a separate discussion, but particularly for adolescents, I am quick to say, hey, these are the things that can happen.
Right. Mm. Right. Mm. Yeah.
Well, I wonder if I could ask you some questions about lifestyle.
Yeah.
As it facilitates healing, recovery, you know, harm reduction from substance use disorders. What do you give advice, coaching to your patients on things such as sleep, diet, and exercise?
I think we have to, and I think that's one of the benefits of having treatment of addiction based out of primary care physicians' offices is because we try and capture what is going on with the entire patient. Mm-hmm. And like I started out by saying with this podcast is that, you know, addiction or substance use disorder is one part of a person's life, right? And yeah. So the fact that diet, exercise, lifestyle changes are paramount. And I think that looks different for everybody. So I would provide kind of my standard counseling for most people, but especially people who are struggling with anxiety, exploring how exercise, exploring how their diet can impact symptoms that often overlap with substance use disorders is huge. And so figuring out where that fits. I think the biggest thing for me is exploring where people are having their sense of community. Because the hardest part of dealing with substance use disorder for most people, I would say, can be the isolation.
Yeah.
And when I see people who struggle with worsening of their substance use disorder, even if it's gotten better over time, I can almost guarantee it's going to get worse when they move. You know, mm-hmm. that's an easy one. You move from living with someone and you move to living alone. That change in accountability is enormous. And you yeah. can set yourself up for failure if you don't have people to talk to about it. Mm-hmm. But then also convincing someone who's never talked to anybody about this before is really a challenge. And so I think that's why when we can start to medicalize a lot of these concerns and creating the bridges, you know, for example, my patients are able to engage at, you know, a substance use for each kind of substance through a clinic we have very close by to our own clinic and kind of a walk-in group session and leave, that gives an alternative to people who are averse to AA or NA who have had negative experiences there. Because, you know, mm-hmm. those programs do provide a community and accountability, but they're not right for everybody. And so that leaves a lot of people saying like, well, I didn't like AA. Where am I going to be able to go and talk with people who are dealing with this who also don't like AA? Mm-hmm. And so I think establishing firm communities for patients is a huge part of the recovery process.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. If our vulnerability to addiction begins very early in life with the attachment pattern that is set for us, right?
Right.
You know, we shield ourselves from the pain of ruptured relationship, detachment, feeling of abandonment, the fear of abandonment or rejection. We find ways to deal with that, maybe with chemical aid.
Hmm.
The way out is has to include some healthy form of attachment, some way to connect with other people.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's a, you know, one statistic or fact that I hate but is true is that women, female patients who use IV drugs, mm-hmm. who have ever injected, it is synonymous with rape or sexual abuse, right?
Okay.
You never meet a female patient who has not had some amount of sexual trauma in their life. And I think you make a good point of referencing attachment, especially early on. And this reflects into the term of adverse childhood events, right?
Right.
Is that
right.
So many of these things start early and impact how, you know, into adulthood, how these relationships are going to be formed. And so you can imagine someone who, particularly a female patient who has unfortunately been the victim of sexual abuse, how hard it is to make those relationships, and how that plays into substance use. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you make a great point about it. It's huge.
And what might also trigger her relapses, you know,
exactly.
How to help think ahead of that a little bit, if you know that history, because that brings me to a question I wanted to ask you too, Hayden, because how much are you all involved in the trauma work that goes into what you discover in most addicts, really? I mean, I know this statistic about the female that is an IV user, but most addiction is rooted in some kind of trauma, is what we're told, and connection, like Nate said, anxiety, connection, trauma, shame. I mean, how do we, do you guys ask a lot of history now more than maybe 10 years ago?
Absolutely. I think, a hot topic or a key phrase you'll hear a lot is trauma-informed care. And I think that there's not a consensus on exactly what that looks like in everyone's clinic, but I would say the gist of it is that it is something that we screen for. And so for my patients who are establishing with me who have a substance use disorder, I always screen for trauma. And there are a variety of forms that you can administer that will do it, that some that are quite lengthy and some that are a bit shorter. I opt for a shorter one, simply to start the conversation. And recognizing that, you know, especially in a first encounter with someone, they don't owe you that story.
Right.
You know, that's a personal thing. And so again, basing this out of a primary care physician's office and someone who you will ultimately have a long relationship with, you know, I have found out some of my patients' traumas, you know, years into our therapy. Mm-hmm. Or into our treatment, just because, you know, up front they didn't want to mention it, and who can, and again, that's not their responsibility.
Yeah. Wow.
But I think it's our responsibility to have that on our minds and to ask about it. Cause if you don't ask about it, you won't, no one is going to offer that information.
The trust factor is huge. And, I can only imagine as a doctor sitting there and somebody thinking that they're coming in basically for, you know, some kind of medical workup or hitting you up for something or whatever the, you know, objective is in the patient's mind, and then getting an empathetic witness to pain, in the process. That's gotta be very trust building for you as a clinician with them.
It is. And I think the thing that we can offer sometimes that can be a barrier to care is the stigma around seeking care from a psychiatrist. You know, some people will just outright say, like, I'm not seeing, you know, the term quack or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to see, you know, they saw a psychiatrist when they were a teenager and they had an awful event and they're never going back. And so oftentimes we can be that bridge to care because, you know, it's different to pull your car up and park and go to a doctor's office than it is to pull up and go to a psychiatrist's office, right? If you're in Brentwood and you know it's a small enough area, people can see where your car is, you may not go seek care at a certain office, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And in some ways go to certain meetings.
Exactly. Same thing.
Same reasons. You know, I used to say that I would rather be caught coming out of a strip club than an AA meeting. That was just
goodness.
Yeah. And I was,
So there you go.
Hayden, I'm sure you've heard this line from Johann Hari's famous TED Talk, Everything You Thought You Knew About Addiction Was Wrong.
Yes.
That the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, but connection. Is that how the line goes? Something like that? Yeah. And so you see kind of this healing connection, this therapeutic connection formed between you and a patient as that patient gains trust in you and just over time discloses more and more of their story to you. You have referenced your clinic. I wonder if you can tell us more about your clinic and especially how it operates relationally.
So it's a continuity clinic, meaning that I have a patient panel of, I don't know how large my panel is. It's close to 500 patients right now, but.
Oh, Lord.
It's a clinic that is what was called a patient-centered medical home, meaning that we rely particularly on an integrated healthcare staff that is cross-professional, meaning that we have integrated pharmacy services as well as, and this is huge for my patients, licensed social workers, and as well as behavioral health specialists, nutritionists, of course, nursing staff. Nutritionists, physical therapists, etc. So everyone can get wraparound care at one site, which is huge. Particularly for my patients, and I mentioned this earlier, you know, I've had patients who struggle with housing instability. And the fact is that until we address the housing instability, I know that the likelihood that they are going to have significant strides in their substance use disorders are very low.
Right.
Because if you don't know where you're sleeping tonight, I almost say, you know, I couldn't blame you if you were to use substances to not think about this very difficult scenario that you're in, because that's often what happens.
Yeah.
And so knowing that, you know, if I can't get you home, I'm not going to make your substance use disorder. And typically in the past, you know, that a doctor could raise their hand and say, well, that's not my job. You know, I'm not there. But, you know, fortunately, I have the resources through my interdisciplinary care, particularly through our social workers, that we're able to help people with those particular problems. I think the other part of that is that when I meet a patient who's in crisis, is that I have my behavioral health specialist for me, because while I'm seeing my patients, I've got 20 minutes for our visit. And I have, you know, 11 patients in my half day. And so I'm not afforded the time to sit down and do an entire crisis assessment with a patient. And I'm probably not the best person to do it. And that's why we have those people integrated on our clinic to what we call a warm handoff, which is for me to say, you know, I'm wrapping up my medical visit with this patient. Would you be able to go in and talk to them and figure out a safety plan and contract them for safety and figure out where they're going to go tonight? And they'll be able to do that over the course of 15 to 20 minutes. And so you'll get to extend somebody's visit while they were just there to see their doctor. And so I think that that's definitely the future of medicine. And we're not going to get into the financing of medicine, but that's the way insurance is going to definitely look at it in term of instead of fee-for-service, but rather trying to keep people healthy. And I think this is the way we have to do it. And so there are a lot of great clinics in the Nashville area that do this too. But I think moving away from just being a doctor in an office, we are not the end all be all by any means.
Hayden, do you think that the future I hate to just say addiction treatment, but because that's so broad, but people with substance use disorders and other, compulsive behaviors and all of that. Do you think that the future of this kind of care is going to be the more multi-pronged approach that your group offers people? Because that seems to me to be kind of a, for lack of a better way to say it, one-stop shop, where I can get medical care, medical assessments, and people that understand what is going on with me physiologically, but I can also get social support and I can get the emotional support and the connection opportunities that I need to emotionally engage and stay healthy if I choose to take part in those. And is that something that you see as the future of treatment? And if so, how can we help usher that in a little more quickly?
I think it is the future of treatment. The having these wraparound services available at a one-stop shop is very helpful, especially when you talk about limitations with, you know, transportation and things like that. The difficulties surrounding this are largely how do these services get paid for? Mm-hmm. And so there are definitely some creative models at how these types of things are working with insurance companies to become billed. Insurance companies lag behind about like 5 to 10 years of the progress that's being made in the other communities. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hopeful that as insurance reform continues to evolve in our country, that we will be able to better support support patients for whom this is a great need. I think there's another question of, you know, is everybody right for a primary care physician to manage this? Mm-hmm. And the answer is not necessarily. So, you know, mm-hmm. certainly patients who need day-to-day accountability, and that is part of their substance use recovery. For example, I think of methadone clinics, right? You have to go every day. Mm-hmm. That's what some people need, and that's what some people like. And that's not something a primary care physician can do. Methadone is prescribed by a select group of individuals. And so those are, you know, clinics that exist that should also offer the same social services that my clinic does. Now, I tell people, you know, because you can go get bad substance use help for somebody just trying to cash in on methadone or buprenorphine. And I can tell you, those are the people that your visits are 5 minutes long and you don't see anybody else while you're there. Like that's not, right. that's not the answer for most people, but some right. people do need more frequent touch points, in which case, addiction specialists are, especially with multiple substances involved, addiction specialists are often the better person to serve those needs.
Yeah. And when you're looking at somebody that, I heard a statistic the other day that the average person that does go to treatment, although we know that maybe only 10% of the people that might, quote, need treatment go, but the person who does go to treatment goes about 3 times over a period of time. Could the case be made to insurance that that's expensive? and maybe... something like more like what you guys are offering would be, in the long run, money well spent.
Right. And certainly our method of approach is cost effective as compared to an inpatient rehab. Now, mm-hmm. that said, some patients do need inpatient rehab, right? Mm-hmm. Some people do need that time away from the triggers in their life. They do need help with their symptoms from withdrawal, particularly for substance use. And so the inpatient treatment, and I'm not here to in any way say it's inferior to what we do, but thinking about cost effectiveness, especially when patients leave inpatient treatment, you know, when patients need to go back, oftentimes it's because there wasn't a great plan out in the community. You know, who right. are they seeing for continued help?
Right.
You know, if it's just a check-in with a psychiatrist once a month, that may not be enough. And so that's the great part about being based out of just a doctor's office, is we have the availability to do more frequent things.
Yeah.
Well, Hayden, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk with us about, you know, what you are learning and what you're seeing there on the front lines of addiction treatment. You've sparked an awful lot of questions in my mind, and I'm sure you're going to spark questions in the minds of our listeners. Mm. So I do want to invite our listeners to write in, and we'll convey your questions to Hayden. Be all right if we copy you on any questions that our listeners send to us, Hayden?
Oh, absolutely. I'm more than happy to answer questions. I can't guarantee all the answers, but I can give you my thoughts.
All right. Well, thanks again, Hayden.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, Hayden, it is great for you to take some time with us, because again, you know, the place on the map that you address this is a really unique one, and I think really needs to be heard. So I really appreciate you speaking into this.
Absolutely, and I appreciate that you all are providing a platform for patients, or rather for people, to connect with your stories and provide them that sense of community that we talked about.
All right, fantastic. All right, listeners, stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
Welcome welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast. And Nate, man, I love Hayden Schaefer. I love this guy, Dr. Hayden Schaefer, MD. That was a great discussion to me about how, and encouraging to me about how younger physicians are being trained to think about the whole concept of addictive behavior and disordered behavior with substances. And what did you think?
You know what I loved about him? You know, he was always a soft-hearted young man. I always knew that. Mm-hmm. And the way, you know, sometimes doctors can become so detached and so clinical. Mm-hmm. To hear that Hayden has not lost the ability to see every one of his patients as a human being,
right,
with incalculable value, and his commitment to social justice and healing, it's so inspiring to me.
Yeah, and the multi-pronged approach that the clinic that he serves is taking as a model for maybe future care is encouraging to me, because there are so many times where I feel like we have this group who feels this way and this group who totally wants to take a medical thought as a departure from another group, and we have all these little fragmented ways that people want to approach this difficult subject, and to know that maybe out in the future somewhere there will be a locked arms ideology about this, brought on by younger people who have less to prove than maybe some of us, I don't know, is really encouraging to me.
So, if you would like to address a question to Hayden or to us, or a comment to Hayden or to us, we'll pass anything along to him that you would like us to. Just drop us an email at positivesobrietypodcast@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. We would love to hear from you.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that about wraps it up for this episode of the show. Until next week, I'm Nate.
I'm David.
We're your pals on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.